Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Arnie Gunderson, an energy advisor with Fairwinds Associates, a company which provides research, analysis and paralegal services around environmental and energy issues. An independent nuclear engineering and safety expert, Arnie provides testimony on nuclear operations, reliability, safety and radiation issues to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, congressional and state legislatures, and government agencies and officials throughout the US, Canada, and internationally. He's been a leading voice globally about the impact of the Fukushima nuclear disaster, and he joins us now. Arnie Gunderson, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Hi, Helen. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Arnie, we haven't talked for about 5 weeks. You're a regular on this program now, and people seem to love to hear you because I think they all really want to know what is going on in Fukushima. So can you bring us up to date now, after 5 weeks, about the latest findings and problems at Fukushima, Arnie?
Well, I think the single biggest thing that happened on the plant site is that TEPCO announced that a large part of the nuclear core melted down from its normal position and melted through the nuclear reactor. It seems that Unit 1 is worse than Unit 2 and 3, but here's what happened. When a nuclear reaction ends, when the control rods fall in, 5% of the heat is still there, not from any nuclear fission, but from all those leftover radioactive isotopes called fission products. So 5% doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're cranking out 500 megawatts like Unit 1 was, 5% is still 25 megawatts. It's a big number.
Define a megawatt, Arnie.
Well, a megawatt is 1,000 kilowatts.
It's a million watts, right?
Yes, it's a million watts.
Yeah.
Or it's 1,100 watt bulbs, something like that, is 1 megawatt. There's a lot of extra heat that has to be gotten rid of. And Unit 1 failed to get heat into the nuclear, failed to get water to cool the heat in the nuclear core real early in the accident. And the fuel began to disintegrate. In the process, it cranked out an enormous amount of hydrogen gas, and the net effect was it exploded. We all saw that on the very second day, March 14th. After that, of course, it was obvious that the core had collapsed, and that's a meltdown. Now, for the longest time, I was saying that it was melting through the nuclear reactor, but TEPCO was saying, no, it didn't get out of the nuclear reactor. In fact, it's likely that it got out of the nuclear reactor within a day.
Well, describe the nuclear reactor vessel. What is it? How thick is it? What is it made of, Arnie?
Well, the bottom of the nuclear reactor is a bowl, and it's about 8 inches thick. So that's, I'm converting here, Helen, 30 centimeters.
Made of what?
And it's made of a steel.
Yeah.
But in a boiling water reactor, it's got 64 holes in the bottom of it for the control rods to go in and out. And what I believe happened is that the nuclear core, the molten blob at the bottom of the reactor, didn't have to melt its way through 8 inches of concrete. And, of course, TEPCO's position is, well, it took a long time to melt through those 8 inches of concrete.
Concrete or steel? Steel.
Oh, steel. Steel. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I need my cup of coffee here. But my position is that it went through one of the holes, and the holes are easily accessible, and it would have drizzled out like soft ice cream. And if one hole failed, it's one thing, but if a whole bunch of holes failed, a lot of nuclear core not only escaped and fell to the bottom of the reactor, but also rapidly escaped from the bottom of the nuclear, the steel, and got to the bottom of the containment. Now, the bottom of the containment is about a meter of concrete. And by this time, after about a day, instead of 5% decay heat, you're down to about 1% decay heat. But that's still, you know, 5 megawatts or 5 million watts of power. And it started to melt its way into the concrete. Most likely, it didn't melt concrete, but concrete pops like popcorn when it gets hot because there's oxygen in the concrete. So as it got hot, it would pop and disintegrate. And the core has gradually worked its way into the concrete underneath the nuclear reactor. Now, we're talking about 70 tons of nuclear material. This is a large molten blob of nuclear material is underneath the reactor. The question is, how deep did it go? And it really depends on when it broke through the nuclear reactor, and I think it broke through soon, but also if it began to attack in a narrow area, it would form a crevice. And if it fell through more uniformly, it would form a pancake. Well, a pancake would be easy to cool because there would be a large surface area. But if a crevice was formed, it would lie in that crevice and continue to work its way downward. Now, by today, so now we're 8 months into the accident, and we are at less than 1 megawatt. So from 25 megawatts to 10 to 1, we're at less than 1 megawatt of decay heat. But it's in a it's now created a crater, essentially, and can't be cooled from above because it's sort of sealed itself off on the top. And it's gradually working its way down into the through the concrete. Now, they claim there's about 30 centimeters left, about a foot left. And they also claim that, of course, when it gets through the concrete, there's still about 2 inches of steel in the nuclear containment. Now, that will melt quickly. The concrete will take a lot longer than the steel to melt. So it is possible that over time the core will continue to melt down and get through the nuclear containment. You know, but whether or not that happens, I think we're not going to have a steam explosion. The people keep talking about, well, when the core hits the groundwater, there's going to be a massive steam explosion. There's not enough heat left, less than a megawatt, to cause a massive steam explosion. And I think it'll drizzle out. I think it will gradually come in contact with water and solidify, as opposed to an enormous mass hitting water suddenly, in which case you would get a steam explosion. But I think the real key here is it doesn't matter. The nuclear core is leaking through the containment anyway. It doesn't have to melt down itself into the groundwater. There's so many leaks in that containment into other buildings and out into the ocean anyway, that all of the water is in contact with the nuclear fuel. And so, therefore, the plutonium and the cesium and the strontium that's in the nuclear fuel has run throughout the entire complex anyway and is getting into the groundwater. So it's moot whether or not we have a real meltdown, melt-through China syndrome. In my opinion, we have a meltdown and a melt-through, which is core collapses, gets through the nuclear vessel. And whether or not it ever has a China syndrome doesn't matter because the groundwater is already contaminated because the containment is leaking elsewhere. That was a very long-winded beginning comment, Helen, and I sort of apologize for making it that long.
No, it's fascinating, Arnie, to hear from you. Now, but these are all calculations because they can't get near this molten corium nuclear mass. They don't really know what's going on. So how can they assume, by which calculation, what calculations are they using to work out the data that you just presented?
That's a great question. You know, you're right. They can't get inside the containment. The containment is so radioactive that they haven't even opened the door and let the robots in yet. They've been outside the containment, and the exposures are incredibly high. So, you know, engineers just make a series of assumptions. Well, they can't get within 100 feet of this to verify. So there is no way of determining where that nuclear core really is. And you're absolutely right. You know, I teach geometry, and the word assume, A-S-S-U-M-E, I always tell my geometry students it makes an ass out of you and me.
Oh, well, so we don't really know. Okay, so now...
Unit 2 and 3 had cooling for several hours longer. And it was the first reactor had something called an isolation condenser. And that was the oldest way General Electric built these reactors was just an isolation condenser. They realized early that that was not a good idea. So on the next two reactors, they put a turbine that runs on the steam created from the accident. And that worked for a couple hours longer until it failed also. So they were cooled by this turbine for a little bit longer.
Oh.
And as a result, TEPCO says 90% of the nuclear fuel has melted in Unit 1 and 60% has melted in Unit 2 and 3. It's still an enormous amount of nuclear material has broken through the nuclear reactor and is on the floor of the containment.
In all three units, 1, 2, and 3. Yeah. Okay, now the groundwater and the amount they've put into the ocean, I want you to address that specifically now, Arnie Gunderson.
Well, they had a leak just this week in the system that they use to purify the water, and approximately 45,000 pounds of radioactive water was released from the building and got into the Pacific Ocean, and it was very high in strontium. And strontium, of course, you'll remember is a bone seeker, and is one of the most nasty chemicals that gets released from a nuclear reactor. So that was a surface leak. It ran out of the building, across the ground, and into the ocean.
Oh, really? Got it.
But in addition, there's cracks in the concrete from the earthquake. You got to remember, this site moved. It dropped a foot after the earthquake. The entire land dropped. And when something, you know, that big moves, it's got a crack. So there's cracks in the containment. There's cracks in the turbine building. Mm. And all of which is allowing groundwater in and radioactive water into the groundwater. So the site is becoming increasingly, the groundwater under the site is becoming increasingly contaminated.
And is the groundwater seawater? Is it salt water? It must be, because it's built right next to the ocean, right?
No, it's freshwater.
Oh, it's freshwater.
The flow is from the land into the ocean. It just turns out that way. So that there's freshwater under the site, and the net flow on site is out into the ocean.
Now,
so we're seeing whatever radioactivity is in the groundwater is also moving into the ocean. So, you know, as it's been said, I said it months ago, but other people have now said it too, that this is absolutely the largest, by at least a factor of 10, radioactive contamination of the ocean that's ever occurred in history.
Well, how much do you estimate has been released into the Pacific Ocean in toto from Fukushima Daiichi?
Well, the number I saw was 30 petabecquerels, and that's 15 zeros. So put 30 with 15 zeros behind it, becquerels, and that's what they believe was released into the ocean. A becquerel is a disintegration per second, but after that disintegrates, there's another one the next second, and another one the next second, and another one the next second for years. So we talk about, you know, this 30 with 15 zeros behind it. It's a million billion. 30 million billion disintegrations per second, continuing over the next 30 years, have been released into the ocean.
Now, is that again a calculation and an estimate?
Everything's an estimate.
How do they work that out, Arnie?
I don't like the assumptions they're using on these calculations. The biggest assumption is something called a decontamination factor for cesium. And they're assuming that only one atom out of 100 gets out of the nuclear reactor, and out of the nuclear containment, and into other buildings. I think that's a miserable assumption. They have a decontamination factor of 100. So that means 1 in 100 gets out and 99% remains behind. It's a poor assumption, but it serves TEPCO's needs. You know, they really want to minimize this accident, and a 30 with 15 zeros is as small as they can get the number, apparently.
Goodness me. You know, when I think as a physician, you know, and a patient in the ICU with profound septicemia and blood poisoning, you could minimize it, but the truth is the patient may be absolutely swarming with lethal bacteria, and despite how much antibiotic you give them, they're going to die. So it doesn't matter if you minimize it or not. The reality is that you probably lose the patient because you're not dealing with accurate data, right?
You're absolutely right, yeah. And unfortunately, both the Japanese government and Tokyo Electric have the same motive, and that motive is to minimize the radiological consequences of this accident. And, TEPCO just yesterday offered 80,000 yen for every person within 30 miles of the plant. That's $1,000. That was their settlement
number.
Oh, that's
big of them.
Now, we've destroyed your entire state, the prefecture of
Fukushima.
And for your troubles, we'll give you $1,000. Yeah, that's so they want to minimize the health risk and minimize the radiation risk to minimize the amount of money they have to pay to the victims.
Well, let's go back to the ocean contamination, Arnie Gunderson. And almost certainly the 30 petabecquerels is an underestimate, as you said, and a becquerel continues to disintegrate each second, so it's 30 tetrabecquerels each second for, I don't know, decades or more. Now, talk about what that means to the seaweed, which the Japanese love, and the fish, and talk about the fish swimming thousands of miles. Talk about the fact that the EPA is not testing the fish that are being caught on the west coast of Canada and the United States. Can you address that issue, please?
We're seeing the radiation is not only coming out from near the plant, you know, and obviously there's an awful lot coming out from near the plant, but now it's also washing down from the mountains. So we're seeing the radioactive cesium and strontium coming down from the mountain streams and collecting in the sediment in the mountain streams when they get to the shallow spots right near where the ocean meets the stream. And, of course, that's where the fish love to eat, in that shallow transition between the ocean and the freshwater. So we're seeing behind dams, we're seeing behind rocks, any place where the water gets a chance to settle out, we're seeing very large quantities, especially of cesium. That seems to be what they're most looking for, but, of course, strontium would be there too. We're seeing large quantities of cesium in the soil. Now, this is fascinating because the International Council on Radiation Protection assumes that strontium is dissolved. In other words, it's
cesium or strontium?
Cesium and strontium are dissolved. And let's go to cesium first. That the cesium is dissolved in the water uniformly, and it just kind of washes out into the ocean. That's not happening. 90% of the cesium is trapped in very small, muddy, hot particles. And, of course, those hot particles lie in the bottom and get absorbed by the root structure of the seaweed, which gets eaten by little critters and works its way up the food chain. And cesium is a muscle seeker, and strontium is a bone seeker. So we're seeing cesium in the fish meat, and we're seeing strontium in the fish bone. Now, the Japanese actually eat fish with the bone as well as the meat. And also, of course, if you cook a stew, you're going to also cook the bone. There's a danger not just of eating what's in the meat, but also the strontium that's in the bone. And now this is working its way into the ocean, not just at Fukushima, but 100 miles north and 100 miles south, because it's running out of the mountain ranges nearby. So we're seeing relatively large fish on the order of 5 or 6 inches, 20 centimeter, 15 centimeter fish, already with high concentrations of cesium. And, of course, those fish are eaten by bigger fish, and eventually it works its way up to the tuna and the salmon and the mackerel at the top of the food chain. And I think it will be, you know, next year before we start to see the highly contaminated tuna and mackerel and salmon. So I'm eating as much salmon as I can this year because I'm a little bit concerned about what will happen next year.
Yeah, but what about the fact that the EPA is not testing the fish caught on the West Coast and probably won't? And, you know, what does that mean?
Oh, I know. It's a travesty. I think, we have in our ports in the United States, we have monitors on the ports to look for nuclear weapons coming in and things like that. And it's likely a year from now that a truckload of tuna will fire off a radiation alarm because it's loaded with cesium. And I think at that point, hopefully, there'll be a whistleblower at the docks to alert the authorities. But you're absolutely right, though. The government's response, the United States government, the Japanese government, and really governments throughout the world, their response to this incident has been to minimize it because there's just way too much money on the line.
It's obscene. Now, Ani, as a nuclear engineer, it's not just strontium and cesium. Please talk about... You know, there are 200 isotopes, radioactive elements, made in the reactor, some of which last seconds and some last millions of years. So what are the other common elements that are being tipped into the ocean at this point in time?
Arnie. I don't know, Helen.
Ruthenium? Ruthenium, americium, neptunium, plutonium... americium, carbon-14, tritium, there are so many. Cobalt-60, almost certainly, radioactive silver, and you just need to get a periodic table and look at all the elements and look at their half-lives to see how long they last, and then you extrapolate and radioactive iodine-129 with a half-life of 17 million years. I mean, this sort of thing. All they're measuring at the moment, it seems, is cesium, it's an indicator of so many other things that they're not talking about.
Yes, you're right. And there's another example is that strontium is emitted from the nuclear reactors. And after 30 years, it decays, but it's not to a stable element. It decays to yttrium. And yttrium decays 12 hours later. So you essentially, when the strontium decays, it's a double hit. You know, you get the strontium decay followed rapidly by the yttrium decay. So there's there's a witch's brew of chemicals in the ocean.
Witch's brew.
You know, there's another thing. You recall last time we talked, you spoke eloquently about the xenon-133 isotope in the airborne contamination. And we just got information that during the first week, so this wasn't just a passing clown, but during the first week, people in Fukushima Prefecture were exposed to 1,300 becquerels per cubic meter of 133. You know, that's medical levels, as you were discussing last time about fat solubility and all that kind of stuff. So it concerns me that they obviously should have evacuated much further, much faster. But there's an exposure that's being underestimated. The Japanese are saying, they didn't listen to our show last month, Ellen. The Japanese are saying, well, it's a noble gas, so therefore don't worry about it. But as you discussed, you know, it's fat soluble, it gets in your lungs and in your tissue and hangs around for quite a while.
Yes, and also if you're immersed in a cloud of xenon-133, you're also receiving high-level gamma radiation externally, like high-level X-rays, as well as inhaling the xenon-133 that is absorbed through the lung and goes to fatty tissue, exposing gonads, ovaries and testicles and other such organs to high-level gamma radiation. But it's not just cesium, Arnie. There are three noble gases. One is xenon-133. There's argon and krypton as well. And they're all high-level gamma emitters as well. So, they're, you know, as is, they only talk about cesium in Japan and maybe strontium. They're ignoring easily, you know, up to 100 other in extraordinarily dangerous radioactive elements, all of which have different life cycles in the biological system and in the human body.
You're absolutely right. And then to add to that list that you just gave, iodine. If there was xenon-133, there clearly had to be iodine too, and that means thyroid exposure.
Oh yeah. Now, okay, so now we should get on to what they're finding. Cesium in babies' powdered milk. That was produced, 200 miles or 200K from the reactor. Talk about that, Arnie, in that they've had to recall 400,000 cans of powdered infant milk formula. Talk about that.
Well, you basically touched on it all. There was they just now discovered, and it had to be there earlier, but it just now measured. Somebody finally looked at powdered milk and discovered high levels of cesium in the powdered milk. There was a recall, although the Japanese government is saying, you really can live with this level of radioactivity in your body. It's interesting because they're making the radioactive banana analogy. And they're saying, well, when you eat a banana, you have potassium 40, and so you're taking in a radioactive isotope, a naturally occurring one. So this is nothing more than eating just a few more bananas.
Is that what they're saying, is it?
Yes, that's what the Japanese government said.
Jeez.
And of course, it's absurd because your body is in... it has a stable relationship with potassium 40. What you take in, you excrete out, and it's just a normal part of your everyday metabolism.
Yeah, but it also could be producing, it's radioactive, and it could be producing some of the cancers that we see already because there's no level of radiation that's safe, and that's background radiation, which is responsible for a fair numbers of cancers, not just the potassium 40, but the radon and radium and everything we live with every day, and that obviously induces quite a few of the cancers that we see and have seen for thousands of years, background radiation.
Yeah.
But if you add to the background radiation by having cesium in infant formula, let me just extrapolate a little on this, if I may, Arnie, as a pediatrician. Fetuses are thousands of times more sensitive to radiation than adults. Infants are hundreds of times more so because their cells are rapidly dividing and it's during the process of mitosis and cell division that genes are very vulnerable to being damaged by radiation, hence it can induce cancer. Children are 10 to 20 times more sensitive than adults, and the nuclear industry uses a standard 70-kilogram white young male as a standard for the amount of radiation to which people can be exposed. But the population is heterogeneous. It's, you know, it's got old people who are very sensitive. It's got immunocompromised patients who are very sensitive. It's got fetuses, children and the like. So let's talk about cesium in infant formula. Cesium is, you're right, a potassium analog, and it goes to muscle and brain. and it causes a very rare form of muscle sarcoma, rhabdomyosarcoma, which is very malignant and extremely dangerous. It also causes brain tumors. It causes ovarian cancers, testicular cancers, and other cancers throughout the body. Now, because these are babies drinking the formula, they're innately sensitive. And from what I've read, the Japanese government says it's nothing to worry about. You know, it's just a little tiny bit. But that is antithetical to anything we know about radiation biology. I can't understand how these people are getting away with this nonsense.
Well, I'll just touch on that. You know, the ICRP, the International Council on Radiation Protection, and the International Atomic Energy Agency are not going to correct it because they have that dual role of promoting and regulating. And right now, it's much more important to promote nuclear power than it is to regulate.
Oh, Arnie, this just takes my breath away. I mean, how many cancers are we going to see from this accident? I predict probably millions. People might
say, I'm at a million myself. I firmly believe that in the first 20 years of the incident, we'll see at least a million new additional cancers above and beyond what you'd expect for a population of that size.
Well, certainly 25 years post Chernobyl, the estimate is more than a million. And Chernobyl, they say, was an accident that was less severe than Fukushima. How would you compare Fukushima now to Chernobyl, Arnie Gundersen?
Well, they say that, again, this is all calculations, Helen, because it's all assumptions. Nobody had radiation detectors to figure it all out. But they say that the total releases from Chernobyl were 75 tetrabecquerels, a million billion. Well, we already know 30 has already leaked into the Pacific. And so it's, even using TEPCO's numbers, were essentially identical to Chernobyl. But actually, the problem is that the population density around Fukushima and, you know, through Japan, it was much greater than the population density in the Ukraine where Chernobyl occurred.
Mm.
And frankly, the Russians got people out a lot faster than the Japanese did. So you've got higher population and a much poorer response for emergency planning from an exposure that was at least as much. Frankly, I think it was more. But even using Tokyo Electric's number, it's at least as bad as Chernobyl. So, yes, I think if you use the Chernobyl numbers and scale up by population density, you'll definitely have more than a million cancers.
Yes, and we must always remember the accident has not yet finished.
That's right. That's right. You know, you mentioned the let's go back to the cesium issue for a split second. You know, your body is not in equilibrium with cesium. Your body is in equilibrium with potassium 40, which you take in, you excrete out, and you're in equilibrium with it. Cesium is not a naturally occurring thing. It was not meant to be in your body, and it replaces potassium. It's a potassium analog, like you said. So that the and cesium is a much more powerful amount of energy it releases on every decay than potassium as well. So the Japanese comparison and trying to minimize the fact that there's cesium in the milk to a very radiosensitive population, the very youngest Japanese, is appalling, if you ask me.
How do you think the cesium got in the milk? They're saying that, you know, they had it drying and it fell on the drying milk. But I suspect as the cesium got into the beef, radioactive beef, that after the cows ate rice hay or rice straw that was contaminated, that the milk itself was radioactive. Would you agree with that, Arnie?
I agree.
Yeah.
The cows are radioactive,
yeah.
And the milk is. They're not sampling all the cows. I mean, initially, all they did was rub the hide of the cow.
Oh, really?
And the hide came up. Yes, the initial test on cesium for the cattle were to rub the hide. They didn't even look at the
good
meat.
God.
Now they're looking at the meat, and oh my God, now they have to look at the milk. So, and they're only sampling a few cattle in a herd. They're not sampling the entire herd. But I think you're right. It came from the food you know, the rice straw is contaminated. We're now at a point where almost all the rice in Fukushima Prefecture has been judged to be not usable. So it's on the ground and has contaminated as much as, you know, 10 or 15% of the entire nation of Japan.
I read that 50% of the rice grown in Japan is grown in Fukushima Prefecture. 50%.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, at least 50% in Fukushima Prefecture.
Yeah, so
is no longer fit for sale.
Now, and Arnie Gunderson, I want you to talk about how much of Japan is contaminated. I've read two different estimates. One is that 50% of Japan is now contaminated with radioactive fallout, but another estimate said it was 8% of the land in Japan is contaminated. What do you say about that?
Well, I think it depends where you set the criteria. You know, if you call contamination 1,000 becquerels per square meter, you'll come up with one number. But, you know, the Japanese consistently are raising the allowable amount. They're lowering the bar to make more and more of the land habitable. So it really depends on what you consider to be a reasonable amount of radioactive cesium to have on the ground in your backyard. It's pretty clear that almost all of the entire prefecture of Fukushima is so contaminated that the best solution would be to remove 2 centimeters, 5 centimeters rather, of soil for the entire prefecture, and that includes the mountain ranges. There's an article in the New York Times from December 6th that discusses the fact that they may have to clear cut the mountain ranges to then get to the soil so they can decontaminate the mountain ranges. Because if they don't, 70% of Fukushima Prefecture is mountain ranges. So if they don't clean the soil, it will continue to run into the rivers, and it will continue to get airborne with passing storms and gusts of wind, and they'll never get to the root of the problem. The New York Times also said that there's going to be parts of Fukushima Prefecture that will, if people ever return, it will not be in the lifetime of the people that are there now. So we're talking about, you know, 50 or 60 years until people can return to some of these areas.
Well, the fact that cesium has a half-life of 30 years.
30 years.
And lasts for 600 years. It's not just, you know, in their lifetime. It's many, many generations. And that's true for areas around Chernobyl too. I had another...
Yeah, they're counting for it to also wash away. They're not going to... not just going to decay away, it's going to wash away. Of course, that then throws more of it into the ocean in the long term.
But Arnie, decontamination is a myth. I mean, you can't decontaminate land. Where are you going to put all the soil that, you know, the millions and millions of tons of soil you've dug up, to dig a deep hole and put it, and then it's going to leak into the underground water system, then rise up into the streams and recontaminate food chains for the rest of time. You can't decontaminate land. You can't. And what they're doing is ploughing school playgrounds and amassing large quantities of soil. But it's kind of like Port Hope in Canada, which is extremely contaminated. They say they'll just... you know, remove the contaminated soil and bury it somewhere else. You can't get rid of the radiation. You can't get rid of it. I think
well,
it's
they're talking
a myth.
About if they just did the habitable, the portions that are inhabited in Fukushima Prefecture, and I agree that that doesn't solve the problem, but if they took off 5 centimeters, 2 inches of soil for the habitable portions of Fukushima Prefecture, they would fill up 50 stadiums the size of the New Orleans Superdome. It's a huge stadium in New Orleans in Louisiana, and of course that doesn't include the mountain ranges.
Mm.
Some Japanese scientists just came out. I can't believe they said this, but they actually said, "Well, the best solution would be to take the dirt that we scrape off our land and take it out into the ocean, yeah, where the ocean is at least 2,000 meters deep. So, 6,000-foot ocean, a little more than a mile, and dump it in the ocean. That's their solution.
Yeah.
There's a lot of international treaties that the Japanese are signatories to that prohibit that, but yet, academians in Tokyo believe that a solution would be to dump it into the ocean.
I can't believe, Arnie Gundersen, that there is not a push, a concerted push by international scientists who understand what's going on to blow the whistle on what the Japanese government and TEPCO are doing, rather than, evacuating hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. They are, if you can't lower the water, you raise the bridge. They're saying, well, look, it's okay now to live in areas which are polluted to thus and thus radiation, whereas before it was illegal. I can't understand why there isn't an outcry from international bodies who understand what's going on. Can you explain that?
I can't either. I'm working with some truly independent scientists, Tim Mousseau, who you had on earlier, and others. I'll give you an example, though. We've been working with Marco Kalthofen, and he's at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And we've been analyzing. People have been sending Marco. They contact Fairwinds, the website that Maggie and I run, and we give them shipping instructions, and they ship car filters to Mr. Kalthofen in Massachusetts, and he analyzes them in several sophisticated devices. We've gotten some car filters from Fukushima Prefecture that are so radioactive that Mr. Kalthofen, has to dispose of them as radioactive waste. He's shipping these car filters to a radioactive waste dump in I think, Texas, where they bury it under 30 feet of soil.
Mm.
So these air filters from Fukushima cars are so radioactive that in the United States, we consider them radioactive waste. And yet the Japanese are doing nothing to warn the auto mechanics who are removing those air filters. There's a lot of money on the line here, Helen, and I'm afraid that within Japan, TEPCO and the Japanese government are closely affiliated and don't want TEPCO to go bankrupt. I believe this will be about a $250 billion cleanup. And, no one has ever spent that kind of money on a cleanup before.
Well,
and, of course, within the United States, we've got a regulator in an industry that also want to perpetuate and increase the number of nuclear reactors worldwide. So there's a lot of financial pressures to minimize the effects of Fukushima.
Well, it's interesting talking about car filters. What about the human filter? And that's the lung. So you could extrapolate from those car filters to human lungs in Fukushima province, and those people must have been inhaling huge amounts of radiation, because with each breath you inhale it, as the car filters suck it in, and it's not excreted, over time it might be a little bit by the cilia washing it out in the bronchi, but the lungs will be accumulating a large quantity of radiation like the car filters.
Yes, and actually what we've done, Helen, on the Fairwind site, back on October 31st, I did a summation of Marco Kalthofen's speech. But just this week, here in early December, there was a professional photographer who did a video of Mr. Kalthofen's speech, and we put that on our website. And he talks about that in the presentation to the American Public Health Association. Marco Kalthofen discusses the fact that these car filters are absorbing just about the same amount of air per day as a human lung.
Yeah.
And here we have to dispose of these car filters as radioactive waste.
Yeah. And what isotopes, elements, are being found in the car filters?
He is not analyzing for strontium, because it's difficult to find. He's found americium, he's found uranium and some others, but predominantly he's looking for cesium-134 and 137. And those are occurring in identical ratios, roughly the same amount of cesium-134 to cesium-137. And that's a sure indicator that what he's measuring came from Fukushima. Mm. Now, the industry would say, oh, well, this cesium's been around since Chernobyl or bomb testing before that or whatever. But what Mr. Kaltofen's looking for is the ratio of 134 to 137. 134 decays much faster. So that if they're both there, it's clear that it came from Fukushima. But clearly there's a lot more isotopes than the ones that I'm talking about right now.
So cesium-134 has a half-life of, what, 2.5 years, Arne Gundersen?
Yes.
So it's around for,
10 to 20 years. So.
Yeah. Is it a more high energy gamma emitter than cesium-137?
No, they're both. Actually, it's predominantly a beta.
But, oh, it's a beta.
They both emit beta and gamma. Yeah. But 137 has a rather unique gamma peak, which makes it easy to find. So, you know, when you're trying to determine a rough magnitude of the problem, one of the easiest isotopes to look for is cesium-137. And, of course, when you find that, then you look for the 134 with the sophisticated instruments he has. We're not talking about Geiger counters. He's using, you know, $50,000 devices that are cooled with liquid nitrogen and things like that. So it's a very high-tech examination he gives these air filters.
Well, so what reaction do the American Public Health Association have to this rather extraordinary presentation by Mr. Kaltofen?
They applauded and went to the next speaker.
Yeah.
You know, I think, though, his ending point was the fact that from a public health standpoint, we need to expand our emergency planning zones. And, you know, that pressure is building up here in the United States and worldwide. The concept of a nice linear, you know, everybody within 10 miles has to leave and after that you're okay, clearly has been, you know, destroyed by the accident in Fukushima, where, in fact, some people in the 10-mile zone didn't have to leave as fast as other people that were 20 or 30 miles away because of the direction of the wind.
Mm.
And we don't take that into account with emergency planning.
Oh, I know. I know.
I think, you know, Mr. Kaltofen's ending remark was we really need to reevaluate emergency planning and consider the fact that these plumes meander and they move and they can very quickly get out to 30 miles and we're not prepared to move people out. Now, I was on CNN during the first week of the accident, and I was saying, I think it's unconscionable that we've got women and children in that 30-mile zone. We've got to get them out, and yet, of course, it didn't happen.
Well, during Chernobyl, the winds changed 360 degrees within the first 24 hours, and the accident went on ferociously for about 10 days and, of course, contaminated 40% of the European landmass for, you know, 600 years. So the plans to evacuate people from 10 miles or whatever are surely ludicrous. It depends upon the meteorological conditions, and the NRC doesn't take that into account. I must say, though, that the chairman of the NRC, Greg Jasko, who worked for Harry Reid, the former Senate Majority Leader, seems to be saying a few fairly basically intelligent, sensible things. Would you agree with that, Arne Gundersen?
Yes, he's the actually the nuclear industry considers him, you know, a rabid anti-nuke because he told people to evacuate out to 50 miles, you know, that was he was chastised here in the United States because of his comments. So that, but in fact, I think his comments have been incredibly reasonable, and he hasn't, and he hasn't backed down from them. So I give him credit for, at least in emergency planning, having some pretty reasonable comments.
So, Arne Gundersen, to finish, what are your predictions about what is going to happen in the future at Fukushima?
Yeah, I don't think there'll be any massive explosions of radioactive corium hitting groundwater or anything like that. I remain concerned about earthquakes because all the buildings are unstable, especially the Unit 4 reactor, which has the nuclear fuel way up high. So a severe earthquake, you know, a 7.5 or something like that, can conceivably topple the fuel pool on Unit 4. And if that happens, we're back to the very first day of the accident. It's an incredibly serious problem. So that's my biggest concern on site. Off-site, I think we've been over it. You know, the decontamination efforts have been haphazard, underfunded, and underappreciated by the Japanese government. And they need to really commit. You know, I think I've said it on your show before. In order to solve a serious problem, you have to admit you have a serious problem. And that hasn't happened.
I want to ask if there was such a serious earthquake as you just suggested that could damage Unit 4, what would happen to Units 1, 2, and 3 and the corium molten mass if there were a major earthquake?
Well, all those buildings are unstable, but the most unstable building is Unit 4. You know, Unit 3 is a mess, and that's the one that had the most serious explosion. And so is Unit 1 to a lesser degree. So it's possible the containments could breach. It's possible that more radioactive steam could be released. And it's there's no science to discuss what would happen if a nuclear fuel pool collapsed, like at Unit 4. No one's ever analyzed that. So that, you know, my biggest fear moving forward, and it's a low probability, the chance of a Richter 7 earthquake, so they have a lot of sixes on the site, and apparently, as I understand seismology, for every 20 sixes, you get a 7. So they're beginning to push the envelope as far as expecting a 7 magnitude earthquake, and an earthquake of 7 or 8 can topple that building, and the fuel would obviously be uncovered, and we're back to the Brookhaven National Lab study at that point. Brookhaven National Lab did a study that if a fuel pool was uncovered, it would begin to burn and could kill 187,000 people from the plume of radioactive smoke that would come out of the fuel. So if Unit 4 were to topple, and again, this is not a done deal. This is a 1 in 100 or maybe even a 1 in 1,000 event. But still, considering the severity of the problem, when you have these low probability, high consequence events, they get quite frightening in my mind. The chance of Unit 4 toppling in the event of an earthquake is, in my opinion, top priority for Tokyo Electric to try to solve.
Okay, so finally, one last question, Arnie Gunderson. After Fukushima and Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, what is it going to take for these nuclear nuts to get the message to realize that nuclear power is totally inappropriate, but more than that, extraordinarily medically dangerous? What is it going to take?
Well, you know, I've been talking more and more and more. My concern is that, let's use North Anna for an example. North Anna had an earthquake here, and it was a 6. And the plant was designed for a 6, and the plant survived the 6. And now the nuclear industry is puffing up and saying, wow, look, we survived what we were designed for. And of course you survived what you were designed for. You're engineers, after all. But the 6 it was designed for was supposed to come once every 23,000 years. And, in fact, it happened after 30 years. So the problem is we're not taking into account what Mother Nature can really throw at us. And until we adequately assess what Mother Nature can really do, the design of these plants has got to be questioned. And we can't feel comfortable if North Anna survived a 6 because it already had a 6. And again, we get to that issue of low probability, high consequence accidents. We really need to reassess the worst that Mother Nature can throw at us. And, you know, the experts the industry hires are, just like at Fukushima, are told Tokyo Electric, told the Japanese government that a 6-meter tsunami was the worst you could expect. And, in fact, they got a 15-meter tsunami instead. My biggest concern moving forward is that we've really, across the board, in every country, have underestimated the severity of a natural phenomena.
Yeah, and I would end by saying, Arnie, that until there's a proper meltdown in America, the industry will proceed.
No comment.
It's a terrible thing to say as a doctor, isn't it? Terrible thing.
Yeah. I hope it doesn't happen. You know, I go to bed at night. I go to bed at night praying that what I think is happening is wrong.
Oh, Arnie. You're a lovely man, you are, and one of the few who can really, really explain concisely and logically what's going on, and I really thank you very much, and obviously we'll have you on again to follow events as they proceed.
Well, thank you, and let me pitch the Fairwinds website here just for a minute, and thank all the viewers who worldwide watch the Fairwinds videos. We really appreciate all your comments.
Thank you, Arnie.
Okay, bye-bye.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Arnie Gundersen, an energy advisor with over 30 years of nuclear power engineering experience in the United States. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you again next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.